This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And this time of year, we, of course, are greeting each other, and happy holidays, Merry Christmas, whatever the particular, you know, affirmation of the season you want to offer, we offer that to you as well. And today, we're actually going to start about talking about a heritage that our state has that isn't terribly unique, but is kind of special in that our main street, for example, goes through the Sauerkraut Triangle in south central North Dakota, which is where we have quite a few people who can claim to be of the heritage Germans from Russia. And joining us to talk about this heritage and a new book that celebrates it is Carol Just, one of the editors of Watermelons and Thistles, Growing Up German from Russia in America. And she joins us by phone from St. Louis Park, Minnesota. Thanks for being with us, Carol.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's start, for our listeners who are not Germans from Russia, a brief recap of this unique group that settled in America.
Oh, I'd be happy to. The ancestors of our heritage originated in various parts of what is now Germany. Germany was not unified until about the 1870s, maybe. And so they come from various districts. And because they're mostly agrarian and they simply could not make things work, there were Napoleonic Wars going on, their sons were being conscripted, their horses were being taken from them. Catherine the Great, the princess from the House of Anhalt-Zerbst, was now Catherine the Great, Tsar of all of Russia, knew that this was happening, and Russia had taken land along the Volga River region and also land near Odessa in the south of Russia. And she believed that if she could encourage her landsmen to come and farm, that that would be a buffer against other enemies. It worked out amazingly. The first ones that came were considered the Volga River region immigrants. Most of them hailed from what's now northern Germany. And then her grandson issued another invitation. The first invitation was in 1763. The second one was in 1804. Most of the Germans from Russia in North and South Dakota, Canada, hail from the Black Sea region. They came later. Communities were developed for them, although nothing was perfect. It took quite a while. But they were such fine farmers, and they had colonial status. They could create their own communities, and they were such hard workers, and they created the breadbasket of the world in what's now Ukraine. It made a difference for the fishing village of Odessa because they needed a port to ship out all that grain. And this went on until their colonial status was abrogated in 1872 by another czar. And by then, the Homestead Act was in full swing in America, and invitations to come to Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, North and South Dakota were issued. And so thousands and thousands left their homes and their beautiful villages in Russia to come to America.
Well, the Germans from Russia have been redefining the meaning of home for more than 200 years. That's on the back of this new book, Watermelons and Thistles. So what do you mean by that? You had to move around a bit, I take it, but the group sort of has a way of finding each other or staying together?
I'm going to quote Professor Tim Cloverdance, retired from NDSU, who said that the Germans from Russia acted locally but thought globally. And so as a group, they would move. The very first ones to come to North America came to Sandusky, Ohio. And Ludwig Betty went back to South Russia and said, "There is so much land here, you should come." And that was before their rights their colonial status was abrogated. So they traditionally have looked for land. They didn't always stay in the same place, even in their states in what's now Germany. They were willing to pick up and move and start again. So we believe that that in the case of our Germans from Russia ancestors, they've been pioneering for 200 years. And the authors in this book, while they descend from the prairie, they live in urban areas, and we call those of us who live in urban areas, we call us the urban pioneers.
And, of course, you were born and raised in Berlin, North Dakota, so you were among those Minnesota, that North Star chapter that is behind this book, right?
Correct, yes. We just celebrated our 40th anniversary as a chapter. We are affiliated with the American Historical Society of Germans from Russia in Lincoln, Nebraska, the Germans from Russia Heritage Society in Bismarck, and we have great working relationships with the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at NDSU, with the Glickstahl Colonies Research Association. As our descendants retired, they became so interested in their heritage, and so these organizations were born. They sponsor great conferences, opportunities to learn. Our chapter is exceptional in that we are education-focused, and we bring in speakers on all kinds of topics related to our heritage.
Well, this is the chapter's second anthology of essays about being German from Russia. This, the book I'm referring to, Watermelons and Thistles. The first one was Hollyhocks and Grasshoppers. What's the significance of the titles?
Oh, the books named themselves. When this endeavor was a dream of mine, because over 40 years affiliated with our organization, I tried to capture as many stories of our members as I could, but realized I just couldn't do them all. And for years, I wanted to pull together their stories. And finally, in 2013, we had 35 stories submitted by 19 authors. We editors would meet weekly. Each editor would take on a couple of stories and authors and work with them. Everything ultimately was edited according to the Chicago Manual of Style, but we worked very hard at never losing their voice. It was so successful that we decided as a chapter to create another anthology, a companion one. And so in 2018, we published Watermelons and Thistles. Both books were named after we had done all the editing. The stories that popped out at us, that's how we got the titles. The working title was always Growing Up German from Russia in America.
Well, chapter one in Watermelons and Thistles is titled Iron in Our Blood, and that's a reminder, to me at any rate, that in parts of North Dakota where there are cemeteries, you've got these iron crosses that indicated that was a grave for a German from Russia.
Mm-hmm. All over Ukraine, you can find iron crosses, and the Catholic Germans from Russia really picked up that art form. But over time, many Protestants also decided that iron crosses were distinctive enough that it sort of marks our heritage.
How would you describe the organization of the essays in this book, Watermelons and Thistles? What was your arc, if you will, your scheme of putting these things together?
We editors would sit at my dining room table, and it was like putting together a quilt. Okay, these stories have that theme. And we have several schoolhouse stories. And, oh, goodness, we have some about war. And so the stories were, they just kind of found each other. And then we came up with our chapter titles. So, Iron in the Blood, it's about blacksmiths, and Tales from the Sauerkraut Triangle, well, it's It's things that happened in what we call German-Russian country. War is about three or four stories about what it was like to go to war, especially when our culture, you know, was pretty pacifist. Part of the reason they wanted to go to Russia was because they had freedom from conscription.
And one of the reasons you left was because you were going to be drafted, wasn't it?
That's right. So when the first children of the immigrants were drafted into World War I, it was a terrible blow.
You are in the first chapter, and your essay is titled Found, My 40-Year Search for My Great-Great-Grandmother. Share that story with our listeners.
Oh, when you're a nerdy genealogist like I am, you just can't dig deep enough, and you're never really happy until you know where everybody came from and where everybody is buried, and you want to know their story. And that second great-grandmother eluded me for 40 years. And as I say in the story, it was not until I just sort of stumbled onto something and discovered that I could use Find a Grave and possibly find her. And I made friends along the way, and I had a colleague from my North Star chapter who was retired and practically lived at the LDS research area. And he said, give me some of your tough cases, because every genealogist has them. They're just sort of black holes. You can't find anything. And I gave him the story of Christina Seeger Heine. And all I had was this grainy photograph. But her daughter was my great-grandmother, who at 21 was one of 16 women to homestead in McIntosh County. And by the time she married, 5 years later, she had three-quarters of land in her name. And she's always been the one of those women that I just hold up as if she can do it, I can do it. You know, she's always been an inspiration to me. But her mother's story was very cloudy. And so my colleague got busy, and we were able to kind of piece things together, but I could not find her grave. It took a long time, but I had the help of several other people.
Well, we've talked about three of the chapters. Again, you're in the first one, Iron in Our Blood and Tales from the Sauerkraut Triangle and War. The fourth chapter has an intriguing title, Out of the Farmyard, Into the Schoolyard and Beyond. What's the significance of that?
Those are mostly school stories, and they're mostly school stories because almost anybody 70 or older in our organization went to country school. And these stories talk about how country school was a good thing. They learned so much, and even though they weren't sure they were prepared to go to the larger public schools, to high school, all of them realized that they had a stellar education. So it features, I think it's three or four stories of members, chapter members, who are, I think all of them, they're in at least their 70s, who were launched in country school, went on to further education if they could, and the world was opened for them. But that early education, I'm looking for the quote from the first story, where he says, I believe that my country school education at Bower No. 2 and the dedicated teachers who taught there more than prepared me for a life of learning.
Well, the next chapter sounds like it's a foodie chapter, Down the Old Wurst and Neffle Lane.
Yep. We, you know, we had a few stories that just seemed to talk about the world of our food ways. know, sausage is a staple, Nepfla is a staple, strudels are a staple, watermelon pickles. You know, we have a cuisine that is pretty unique, and so we have stories that celebrate that.
The next chapter is One Foot in the Old Country, and you've been back to the Old Country, haven't you?
I have. I have probably visited 17 of my ancestral homes. I think that's my last count. Mm-hmm. In both South Russia and in what's now Romania and in Germany and France and Poland.
What's it like to go back to the Old Country? Because in a way, you were people without a country in a sense.
You know, for me personally, but I think I speak for a large group of people, we know that our ancestors surrendered and started over so many times, and that they are the inspiration for us. And just being able to walk the streets of their villages is inspiring for us. And the homeland tours offered by the Germans from Russia Heritage Collection at NDSU, that was my first journey. I visited 1, 2, 3 of my villages in South Russia. And then I think my next venture was into Poland, because I had some relatives that they didn't pioneer once or twice. Sometimes it was 3 or 4 times, spending a decade or two in one area. So it was then Prussia. And so I visited that ancestral village. Last summer, I hit 13 more in and around Berlin and in and around Stuttgart and near Strasbourg, France, and Sessenheim.
Is the Germans from Russia heritage acknowledged and celebrated there as well?
In some ways. In Stuttgart, there are two major organizations of Bessarabian German Russians and what's now Ukraine Germans from Russia, and those are all government funded. So they have excellent resources for research.
Well,
there, and they have annual conferences. In fact, in our first anthology, we had 3 stories that were so appreciated by an organization in Germany that they asked if they could translate the stories and publish them in it's like an almanac, their Heimatkalender.
And we should mention that the last chapter is, I guess, a toast of sorts. Schnapps, anyone?
Yes. Well, among the Kuchen and the Strudel and the watermelon pickles, we also are famous for our homemade moonshine, hooch. now it's made from Everclear, but in my home, having a shot of schnapps before a meal was simply commonplace. I helped my dad make burnt sugar schnapps from the time I was a little girl. It was just part of our culture. And the first story there is one that I really love by Mel Meyer. It's What We Choose to Remember. Now, Mel said, oh, Carol, I don't have anything to say. But for this anthology, I handed out a list of suggested topics and guidelines. And Mel just sort of went, check, 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 and wrote about his family based on those suggested topics. And it is poignant. It is in the voice of this young boy living near Napoleon, North Dakota, and what life was like. And also in this anthology, we created what we call sidebars, because we realized that we had a greater audience than just Germans from Russia.
Well, we'll have to leave it there, but I appreciate you taking us through the book. Carol Just is the editor, one of the editors of Watermelons and Thistles, Growing Up German from Russia in America. Thanks for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Coming up next on Main Street, Natural North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bremer Wealth Management, offering client-centered wealth planning, asset management, and trust services to help clients reach financial goals. Learn more at bremer.com. Bremer Wealth Management, for what's ahead.
There's a term in the social science world for people who stick their heads in the sand to avoid bad news. It's called the ostrich effect. I'm Shankar Vedantam, and believe it or not, some listeners turn into ostriches during membership campaigns. Now, we know that you'd never do that, but a close friend of yours, they might. Catch my drift? Set a good example for that friend and make a year-end gift now.
Make your year-end tax-deductible gift to Prairie Public by calling 800-359-4145, going to prairiepublic.org, or by texting the word SUPPORT to 484848 and click on the link.
For those of you who have made that year-end gift, thank you for doing that. We love our listeners, but our members make it, of course, possible. And Prairie Public and Main Street would not be possible without members. So if you've been thinking about it still, there are still a few days left in December before that other tax year begins. And maybe you could think of us as a year-end gift because, after all, you're using us right now. 800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org and click on Donate. Sport fishermen have their favorites. Many prefer the walleye, some like the feisty northern, and others compete for bass. The carp is not as popular. Today, Chuck Lura's Natural North Dakota essay offers a bit of history about how the carp got here and why its behavior can be problematic for anglers.
I recently saw a news item about a project to improve the water quality of Lake Nokomis in South Minneapolis. So just what does it involve? It might surprise you, but the answer to that question is carp removal. Most everyone knows that carp are not native to North America. They're native to Eurasia, where they have a long association with humans. The species has been farmed and domesticated since at least the Roman times. The common carp was popular table fare. Plus, it has a history of being a popular item in both rural and urban ponds and water gardens. Not surprisingly, koi is the same species, and goldfish are a close relative. Many sport fish populations declined markedly in the 1800s, before harvesting regulations were implemented. That in part led to a public pressure for the introduction and cultivation of carp in the mid-1800s. The effort involved both state and federal entities, and no doubt some independent efforts as well. We all know the rest of the story. They were deliberately and inadvertently introduced into lakes, rivers, and streams across the country, and the carp did a little too well. By the early 1900s, they were becoming a nuisance. Once prized, now despised, is a phrase sometimes used to describe the common carp. Carp can significantly change the ecology of a body of water. Carp are omnivorous bottom feeders. As they feed on a plant and animal material on the bottom of the body of water, they stir up the sediment. That puts more sediment in the water column, which of course makes the water more turbid. Predatory game fish, which are often our sport fish, are less able to see their prey. And of course, less light is available for the aquatic plants. That can mean less food and cover for many desirable aquatic animals, ranging from invertebrates and fish to waterfowl. Plus, the nutrients from the sediments are released into the water, which may then be taken up by algae, resulting in algae blooms. It's a cascade of events that, from several perspectives, is not desirable. As for North Dakota, the common carp appears to have made it here via the Missouri River. They first showed up in the state in 1929 in the Cedar and Hart Rivers, both tributaries to the Missouri. Carp can now be found in several rivers and streams across the state. Hopefully, the techniques to reduce or eliminate the carp from Lake Nokomis will work. If so, perhaps the techniques could have applicability here in North Dakota. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Coming up on Main Street, our weekly discussion of the week's big stories with News Director Dave Thompson, and a new movie review from Matt O'Lean. First, a news update.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Despite the ups and downs and increased challenges, the executive director of the North Dakota Trade Office says 2018 has been an overall positive year for North Dakota companies.
It looks like it's going to be an up year for us in both categories. The only challenge is, and it depends on the final numbers for the ag side, because we're about a $10 billion shipping state, so we export about $10 billion of products. Again, 1.3 of that $10 billion has typically been soybeans, and some beans have gone out and gone to other markets, so that may fluctuate a little bit, but with petroleum and some of the other manufactured, we've actually had a pretty good year with manufactured products exported out of the state.
Simon Wilson says even though there are positives of the year, it doesn't mean there hasn't been some damage from all the disruption that has taken place.
The steel and aluminum tariffs are impacting. It depends on how much you have of your steel content or your aluminum content in your products of how much it affects you. But we do know there's some of our manufacturers that are struggling because of the shock increase that goes into their pricing side. And they're trying to figure out how long do we do it, because the tariffs, it's not a permanent number for them. So they're trying to understand, do they pass that full price on? Do they take some of that and impact some of their margins?
Wilson says it's a delicate balance right now. He says there are hopes some stabilization will take place once the new USMCA trade agreement with Mexico and Canada is ratified. A new scam involving the online purchasing of vehicles is hitting the region this holiday season. Bess Ellenson is communication director for the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota and North Dakota. She says it begins when someone is looking to purchase a vehicle on Craigslist or other local website. She says the vehicle is usually listed for a too-good-to-be-true price, so they contact the seller. The seller then relays a sob story to the buyer about an unfortunate circumstance as to why they need to sell the car right away, like a death in the family or financial emergency. Ellenson says a story like this can make a buyer feel bad and more willing to help the seller out of this situation. That's when the seller makes their next move.
If the buyer decides, you know, seems interested, the seller tells them that they want a third party to handle the transaction just because it's safer and it protects both sides. So then, you know, if the buyer decides to go through with the purchase, they contact this third party, which is actually a second end of the scam, and they're asked to wire money. And so if the person decides to wire money, and, you know, they obviously will realize soon enough that it's a scam because the seller, the shipping company, everyone just goes silent. So they are out their money and they are out a vehicle also.
Ellenson says the BBB has received about 20 reports regarding this kind of scam in the region, so it's important to watch for red flags and read listings with a critical eye. And the first of three UND winter commencement ceremonies was held Thursday afternoon at the Chester Fritz Auditorium. Leading things off, the ceremony for graduate and professional students. More than 270 received diplomas. UND President Mark Kennedy advised the graduates to embrace change.
But as time rolls on, your success will depend more and more on you thinking critically and continuing to prepare to ride the waves of change rather than be washed up by them. Better yet, make us UND proud and unleash waves that others will have to surf.
Two more ceremonies for more than 600 eligible undergraduates were held today. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, that sound of the old wire machine means it's time for us to talk about the news. And by us, I mean our news director, Dave Thompson, who joins me on Main Street every Friday. Thanks for being with us, Dave.
Oh, you're welcome, Doug.
Let's start with some welcome news that came on Tuesday this week. North Dakota has a waiver on those background check rules for daycare employees that have been causing some real problems.
They have been causing problems because we are talking about fingerprints. And the new rule says that a person who is hired cannot work in the organization until the fingerprint background check has been completed. The old rule used to be you could work under supervision, so you could have another staff person there, and the staff person can watch you while you work to make sure everything is fine. And that has caused some real problems because it's taken a while to get the results of those fingerprints back, and by that time the people don't want to stay around and wait for that to be back, and then they're hired someplace else doing something else.
Well, this means, of course, that when the legislature convenes, among the other issues that they'll be wrestling with in terms of budgetary issues is providing enough support to do that at the state level.
Right, and it's going to cost a little bit more to get that going because you really want that to be done. The providers say they want that done within 72 hours, and right now it's taking up to a month.
Yeah.
So now if you get it done within 72 hours, you know, that's going to take probably more staff, more equipment.
Well, we had talked with Robin Nelson, the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of the Red River Valley, and she had expressed real concern about the enforcement of this rule. So this has to be a breath of fresh air for her and others in this.
I followed up with her after the waiver was granted. She sounded very relieved at that point.
Well, let's talk about something that just happened today. You posted this This morning, a wind farm developer will pay a $60,000 fine for violations of a setback agreement with the Public Service Commission.
This is in McHenry County. The agreement was you had a minimum 1,400 feet setback from occupied homes, from road right-of-ways, and from power lines. Well, they're putting up 41 turbines, and five of them they found do not quite fit the tolerances. There are a couple that are too close to a house. You know, they're within 1,300 feet, not 1,400 feet. And we've got some that are close to Highway 41 and one close to a high-voltage power line. So the company was good enough and said, hey, we made a mistake here. They talked to the PSC and they got a waiver on that. However, the PSC decided, and they talked about that with the company too, to fine them $60,000. And the reason they fined them $60,000 is kind of to demonstrate to everybody, you know, if you've got these projects, you know, don't go whole hog. Don't try to get them finished now. You know, make sure you do the due diligence to make sure everything is right.
Well, it occurs to me that $60,000 might be a stiff fine, but it's a lot less than moving one of those huge towers and turbines.
Right, and they are moving one of them, as a matter of fact. There's going to be one that's going to be moved. So it is now with, you know, outside the 1,400-foot buffer.
All right. Well, let's talk about another budget issue that you were reporting on earlier this week on Wednesday. You posted that long-term care facilities in North Dakota are looking for more money than what's in Governor Burgum's budget.
And, right. And you go back to they haven't had any increase in funding for 3 years. Now the governor has proposed a 1% increase in funding, and the Long-Term Care Association people say, you know, we're going to lose people if that's all you're going to do is 1%, because you have to operate, you have to pay bills. And what are you going to do? How are you going to pay your staff? And they like to go to 3%. That'll give them a cushion. It isn't really a lot if you think about 3 years with no increase. And why there were 3 years? Because you had the 2 years of a no increase from the 2017 legislative session, and you had the 1 year of allotment before that. And we often forget about the allotment, where they did have to slice budgets to make ends meet.
And we need to remember as well that 1% in a year that Social Security is offering an almost 3% boost in benefits indicates that the cost of living needs to be adjusted.
Exactly. It is a cost of living thing. And, you know, I was talking to the person who is out there in Watford City, and he says, well, during the time when oil had slowed down, it was okay because we had people who were willing to come to work to us. But now that the oil seems to be going back up, they're not able to recruit. And they're worried that if you do a 1% thing, you're not able to offer a competitive salary.
And if you've been in a nursing home, you know that is not easy work.
That's very tough work. And God bless them all, because they really are dedicated people to make sure these residents are taken care of the best way they can.
Well, let's talk about another issue that was in the governor's budget proposal that is having some reverberations in New England, North Dakota, where the Women's Correctional Rehabilitation Center is located. There's some real pushback there.
There is some real pushback, and not only from the mayor of New England, who is worried about losing some permanent full-time jobs and some very well-paid jobs. If you're working for the penitentiary system, you're getting paid a decent wage. And he's worried about losing that. And if you go back to it, go back to 2 years ago when the legislature decided to close some of these DOT garages where they have people and snowplows, New England was one of them that was closed and said you could get it from Dickinson. Well, you know, if you've got a snowy day, New England argues that that's still 15 miles away. So can you get somebody from Dickinson in time to plow the streets? And that's a real challenge. So you've got that, and then the idea of closing it and moving the women to the MRCC in Bismarck, moving the people to the MRCC to Jamestown, and it's kind of like a domino effect.
Well, the women's prison warden, is it Rochelle Juntunen?
Right.
She is really pushing back about the effect this is going to have on New England. And we're reminded that North Dakota is, you know, largely rural state. Some of these state institutions are vitally important for the economic life of these communities. So.
Right. And I hate to bring that up, but, you know, there's a little tangential relationship with the university system, because remember, we voted on a few times to close some of the institutions, and we voted it down because those institutions are very important to those communities in terms of economic development. And even though it's, you know, it's a prison, it is important to the city of New England.
Well, let's talk about something that is related to what you just said. There's this very big football game today.
Boy, is there ever.
North Dakota State University versus South Dakota State University in the semifinal for the football championship series in Division I, and a big deal. And, of course, that reminds us that North Dakota and South Dakota compete on a number of levels, including for students. And last Friday, we were talking about the issue of matching South Dakota's decision to go to in-state tuition for all their students, or at least with the neighboring states.
Right.
And that puts North Dakota at a disadvantage.
Well, I will tell you, there's a little update on that because next week, the Budget and Finance Committee is holding a special meeting to discuss this issue. And for NDSU and the North Dakota State School of Science, they're going to be talking about giving the presidents a little bit more leeway for setting tuition for those students who want to come up from South Dakota and some of the other states that South Dakota is reaching out to do. So, you know, they're talking about getting it ready so it's ready to go by summer when the real recruiting for students starts. And I think you're going to see some leeway there.
Well, there's also recruiting for those football players. And we should note for our listeners who probably know that Chris Kleiman is going to Kansas State University, the
right.
home of the Wildcats. That's Division I.
Division I, yes.
FBS series. So he's got a big promotion there. And Matt Enns, the defensive coordinator for NDSU, is going to be the new head coach. So congratulations to him. And here's hoping NDSU can prevail today.
Absolutely. And that'll be tonight, right?
7 o'clock?
7 o'clock.
Big sort of political story that's kind of interesting. I saw this posted by John Hageman in the Forum News Service. North Dakota Republicans have voted against a suggested change in the primary election law.
Yes, and they're talking about maybe not even having the primary, but just having the local conventions and the state convention choose the candidates. Well, you see how that's worked out. Let's go back to Governor Doug Burgum. He defeated Wayne Stengem, who got the primary nomination. He defeated Wayne in the primary, and he is now the governor of North Dakota.
And Kevin Cramer.
Kevin Cramer, who did that with Brian Kolk. Plus, you had the situation where Al Jager was denied the nomination, and then the one that they endorsed at the convention had to drop out, and then well, the trouble with that, it wasn't really on point, but Al Jager did not run and challenge in the primary, although he could have. And they thought maybe he could have won that primary challenge, but they asked him not to do so for the unity of the party. And there were a couple of legislative changes, and I have been talking to some people that some of this might be coming from a couple of legislative districts where there were some primary challenges to some people who were endorsed by their local conventions.
Well, let's end with this proposal that I saw written by Jack Dura in the Bismarck Tribune. The North Dakota Supreme Court Law Library aims to save money and space because we've got online stuff these days.
I like the quote from Justice Gerald Vandewalle, Chief Justice, who said, "Let's face it, books are passé." And I thought, that's very true. Everything is going digital. And it will save a lot of space, you know. That law library is chock full of documents, chock full of hardbound books, and it's fascinating to go. I look through there quite a bit because in order to record the Supreme Court hearings, you have to plug in the library, so you're one floor above the court. But when I get a chance, I kind of wander around the library and just marvel at some of the things that are there.
Well, do it while you can, Dave.
Absolutely.
We check in with our news director every Friday.
I'm Corva Coleman. Politics dominated the headlines in 2018, but it was a big news year for a lot of other reasons, too, like the cave rescue in Thailand that captivated the world.
All of the kids and their soccer coach have made it out of the flooded cave in northern Thailand.
So much happened in 2018, and we were there for it all. Here's how to help us tackle 2019.
Just call 800-359-4145, go to praypublic.org, or make your year-end tax-deductible gift by texting the word SUPPORT to 484848 and click on the link.
And you know what members do? They help pay for the cost of operating a statewide radio and online network. You know, the transmitters, the online stream and apps. and a dedicated and talented staff that work at Prairie Public and help bring Main Street to you weekdays from 3 to 4 Central. So think of all the you've learned over the past year by listening to Main Street. Interviews, engaging features like Tom Eason's Plainsfolk essays, Sue Balcom's fun food feature. Give us a call, 800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org and click on Donate. It's time to go to the movies with our Matt O'Lean. And this week, Matt, you went to a movie with a very intriguing title and a true story behind it. Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Yeah, this is going into one of my favorite movies of 2018. Now, we haven't seen everything yet. There's a lot of stuff coming in December, but this is right up there. One of the best films I've seen this year. Director Marielle Heller, who also directed Diary of a Teenage Girl a couple years ago, which was an interesting movie, takes the director's chair for this one. This is the true story of Lee Israel. Now, she was a writer of biographies in the 90s. She's played by Melissa McCarthy, and she needs money. Her books aren't selling. She can't get a gig. And she sort of happens on to an old letter by Fanny Bryce, the famed vaudevillian. And she gets an idea. It's all in the trailer. There's no giveaways here. To start typing up letters from famous people, but she's misquoting them. She's putting her own quotes in, and she tries to sell them to make money. But of course, these are forgeries. Now, she invents quotes by Noel Coward, Dorothy Parker, Lillian Hellman, people like this. And that's where the film goes. It's fascinating, her little conversations with booksellers as she goes in to try to sell these things, and they're very interested. And yes, I'd be very interested in this. But of course, the con is on. The game is afoot. And what Heller does so well in this film is she makes the process of writing interesting on screen. That sometimes is something hard to pull off in movies, Doug, is the process of a writer being a writer. And sometimes that doesn't come off very cinematically, but it does in this. There's suspense that she builds with what McCarthy is doing. There's empathy toward McCarthy and her character, even though she's a very unlikable character. She's not nice to people. The only really friend she has is a cat. And McCarthy is really good in this role. I've heard a couple people say, well, it's kind of just a variation on sort of the one-liners and the characters that she's played since Bridesmaids. But I think she digs a lot deeper here. She's already gotten some awards buzz. I think she's going to get a Best Actress nomination. You can tell the anguish in her face when she doesn't connect with the person that she wants to connect with. And so I think this is the best performance she's ever given. She's unsympathetic. It's kind of a character with warts and all. You get a very pared to the bone, right up against the marrow of what she is like as a person. And McCarthy's fabulous. I want to also credit Richard E. Grant, who is getting some supporting actor buzz already. He's already got the New York Film Critics supporting actor. He's a veteran British actor. People will know his face. He's phenomenal as kind of this streetwise hustler that she met before at a party, and he becomes her kind of accomplice in crime, and he's really good in this role. It's a role that could earn him an Oscar after all these years. He's about 60 years old. He's funny. He's sympathetic. He's touching. I won't give you his backstory, his character's backstory, because that's really crucial to what's going on here, especially what's going on in the early 90s. I also love how Heller makes New York City a character. We get New York City in the winter, Doug. There's snow, all these little bookshops she goes into. So New York City becomes a character, much like Woody Allen has made New York City a very interesting character in his films. It's a very good film. It's not a very long film. Doesn't outstay its welcome. It's fascinating, and I really loved it.
I was reminded of John Irving, who wrote that unauthorized and fraudulent or autobiography. He was going to write it about her. Howard Hughes.
Clifford Irving, not John Irving. Clifford Irving.
Clifford Irving,
yes.
And this is years and years ago, and he supposedly forged letters from Howard Hughes. And Howard Hughes, who was a recluse at the time, famously made a phone call and said, it's not authorized. And that house of cards just collapsed.
Yeah, that's kind of what this is about, is she needs money. And she's actually proud of her writing in the film. She's very proud of how she thinks Dorothy Parker would have written a letter to someone, or what she thinks Noel Coward would have written in a letter to Peter O'Toole or someone like that, a friend. And so she's proud of that. She's a good writer, but it's not her words. And that's of course, the great rub. Whether you're doing a film review or writing a book, you have to be very careful not to lift people's phrases. And it becomes a huge issue on college campuses, as you know, Doug, with kids lifting stuff without citing their sources. So it's really fascinating to me how they made a good movie out of this character, because she is not a sympathetic character. What I like, too, is that this film never gets sentimental. It could have easily gotten sentimental. It could have easily been very triggered in terms of kind of the what it's trying to make the audience feel. It never does that. These are non-likable characters. Richard E. Grant doesn't play a likable character either. But you sort of keep watching, and you sort of do have some empathy toward them at the end. You know, how we get to that end, people are going to have to go see this film and find out for themselves. But I liked the unsentimental approach.
And Lee Israel wrote this memoir.
Yes, she did.
So it's
about her forgery.
Kind of comes full circle in a way here.
It does. It's a really good film. I really encourage people to go see it. I think McCarthy and Grant are going to be both right in there with Oscar nominations.
Oh, I was reminded when I was looking into the film that Melissa McCarthy, besides being a stand-up comic and, of course, having all those wild roles she's done, like in The Bridesmaids, was a member of the Actors Studio, so she's got some serious chops.
She does have chops, and you see it in this film. I really was impressed with what she did. At first, when the film starts, it feels like I'm watching Melissa McCarthy. And after a while, I feel like I'm watching this very morose New York writer that I didn't know anything about. So she does disappear into the character. She does it very effectively, and there's no comedy here. There's little one-liners. But we get backstory of how her failed relationships she's had with people, and that anguish is delivered by McCarthy in a very effective way.
Well, I mentioned we talked about Clifford Irving and Howard Hughes and all that kind of thing. So I was, you know, struggling with an Oscar trivia question this week, and the one I came up with I think is way too easy for you, but here we go, because our listeners might be intrigued by this. Who was the screenwriter who was awarded an Oscar under a pseudonym because he had to write clandestinely?
Dalton Trumbo, and I think he won two of them.
He did, but one actually used a pseudonym, and that...
Roman Holiday?
No, that used the primary, the front writer, the brave one.
The brave one, yes, that's right, that's right.
And he wrote that screenplay as Robert Rich, a name he borrowed from a nephew of one of the producers.
And I encourage people to see the movie Trumbo, starring Bryan Cranston, that came out about 3 years ago. Fascinating about how he writes the scripts to Spartacus and Exodus, and they're competing to who's going to reveal his name first.
And as you've said, Kirk Douglas, who's now over a century old, famously
he
helped Dalton Trumbo get that credit.
Yeah, Kirk has said that's the proudest moment of his artistic life.
Well, we've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity for 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to the Mexican border.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 14th. On this date in 1911, the Department of Interior submitted a request to Congress for $2,500 for the improvement of Sully's Hill National Park. While the area was designated as a national park, Congress had never appropriated the money for its improvement or protection. The superintendent of the Indian school at Fort Totten kept an eye on the property, but the park had no staff. Located on the shores of Devil's Lake, Sully's Hill was designated as a national park in 1904 by Teddy Roosevelt. It was named after General Alfred Sully, but the park was remote, lacking riverboat or road access, and it had no buildings or other improvements. Consequently, it received few visitors. In fact, Roosevelt himself never visited the spot. It made more sense to repurpose the land, so in 1914, the park's designation was changed to a National Game Preserve. Congress transferred management to the Fish and Wildlife Service in 1931. It is one of only 7 national parks to be disbanded. The area's 1,674 acres is home to a small herd of bison, with the population kept to about 20 animals in keeping with the available land. In 1917, 15 Rocky Mountain elk were introduced. This herd is kept to less than 18 animals. In the autumn, the bull elk can be heard calling loudly to attract cows. Prairie dogs also make the park home. The colony was introduced in 1975 to provide an educational experience for visitors about the playful rodents that dig intricate underground dens and tunnels. It's estimated that up to 270 species of birds can be found at Sully's Hill. It's both a breeding ground and a stopover site for migratory birds. Among them are the yellow warbler, the pileated woodpecker, and night herons. The preserve includes a variety of habitats with woodlands, mixed grass prairie, and wetlands. It's a popular destination for photographers. There are 2 miles of hiking trails and a 4-mile drive that takes visitors through all the habitats. Observation decks offer good views of the wildlife. There are also interpretive and educational programs provided by the rangers. And even in winter, the park is quite an attraction, with snowshoeing on the 2nd and 4th Saturday, January through March. Bring your camera, but the snowshoe rental is free. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
It's so cold. My ears are about to freeze off. I sure could use a...
Ho, ho, ho. What would you like for Christmas?
Mama says never leave the house without a...
Is that Men Without?
Hi-oh!
Is somebody trying to tell you something?
In a conspiracy like this, you build from the outer edges and you go step by step.
Somebody you love wants to see a Prairie Public beanie under the tree.
That's you, Santa Claus!
For just a $15 a month sustaining membership, we'll give you a very cool, very warm navy blue Prairie Public winter hat. And you'll get it in time for Christmas.
Fragile! It must be Italian.
Tis the season of giving. Think about what Prairie Public has given you over the past year.
Just call 800-359-4145, go to prairiepublic.org,
or text the word support to 484848 and click on the link.
Happy Holidays!
Well, if you like that hat, that wonderful navy blue Prairie Public winter beanie hat, you know how to do it now. It's a matter of picking up that phone and making that toll-free call at 800-359-4145 or going online to prairiepublic.org and clicking on donate. Monday on our show, we'll talk with Clay Rutledge about his new book, Supernatural: Death, Meaning, and the Power of the Invisible World. Rutledge is a psychology professor at NDSU, and he says humanity's quest for meaning is why we're drawn to supernatural beliefs. And the old school in Nome, North Dakota was abandoned for decades. Now it's being repurposed. We'll talk about its future with Teresa Perlberg and Chris Armbrust on our show on Monday. And you might want to take in Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.